The hope, done sensibly, is that the incentives for investment and economic growth will bring in enough growth and therefore tax revenue.
This is the Wintrust Business Lunch, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank, on 720 WGN.
720 WGN, John Hansen in for Steve Bertrand today and for the next few days on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for spending your day after Christmas this Wednesday afternoon. It took me a long time to figure out what day of the week this actually was, having yesterday off for the Christmas day, which I was blessed to have the day off, but it really has thrown off my week. Yes, it is Wednesday, and the markets are doing pretty good. And the reason why is they knew that Terry Savage was going to be joining us today on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Terry, anytime you come on, you like to bring some good news and positivity, and today feels like a good day. Christmas Eve felt like a terrible day markets-wise, but I got to say your column of the Savage Truths about the stock market. Terry, what I love about your columns is they work when the markets are up, they work when they're down, because they're just a realistic look at the long term, which is really what we should all be looking at.
Yeah, well, it's a personal thing. The markets make headlines. I don't think anybody feels as good today about the stock market, even though it's back up about 500 points, as they did before Christmas Eve, mm-hmm. when the market plunged 600 points. This is not a very big point difference, but it's a reminder that these are volatile markets. And again, it's not the headline numbers. It's not the Dow. I mean, over the long run, you can look at the trends. We've had a 10-year bull market. We're still way up from when you were panicking in 2008 when the Dow went below 7,000. But the point is, what matters most is, how are you sitting? How upset are you? Are you able to ride it out? Are you at a stage in life where you can ride it out and actually buy more on a regular basis? Or are you going, oh my goodness, if this disappears, so does my retirement. And you're real close to it at this point. If you are, then these kinds of things are very unnerving.
Yeah, and it's interesting because you're absolutely right. Like at where I'm sitting right now, I'm still a good 30 years away from retirement. So I don't even, I pay attention to the numbers because we talk about them. But for me personally, I'm just kind of sitting idly by, still putting the money in as I can. And just because I know, there's never been.
Oh, John, come on. You know that the day that you go, oh my God, I think Terry Savage is wrong. I think it's really all over for America. Oh my God, maybe I should sell. That will be the bottom of the market. See, you just said the news of a bull market. So you think you're going to be calm, which tells me that we haven't had enough terror in the market yet.
Mm-hmm. Oh, you're absolutely right.
You can sit here on radio casually and say, yeah, no, I'm going to ride it out. The day you call me before we go on the show and go, Terry, is this it? I'm really scared now. Mm-hmm. Then I'll know it's the bottom.
Yeah, that's when you'll know. Yeah, exactly. Hey, I got to ask you, though, Terry. I love in your column when you say the stock market doesn't care about your money. Walk us through what the reason is and elaborate a little bit more on that.
I've written a series of about five or six columns going back to spring when I told people how to buy treasury bills, chicken money, or you don't get rich, but you don't get poor. Talking about the fact that we've had an incredible bull market and that you need to know what you own and think about how terrified you would be, how it would impact your personal situation if you are close to retirement or in retirement and you see those wonderful numbers in your 401k or IRA rollover start to plunge 10, 15, 20% or more. And we know I've personally been through four bear markets that have had the market down nearly 50%. So that's a scary moment when and if that would happen again. What I've been trying to say is you want to take some of those profits. And in every which way, about 4 weeks ago, I wrote a column about how to hide inside your 401k. 401ks are designed for people to accumulate money, so they don't have money market funds for the most part. Many of them, though, have very short-term bond funds or stable value funds. And I've been done what I could to try and get people to be in a position where they won't panic when and if this a market decline gets worse than it is now. So it's not about the day-to-day fluctuations. It's about the impact on your own retirement. And the stock market doesn't know or care that you really need this money. That's your job. And for all the people that are in those target date funds that are still 75% in stocks and you're close to retirement, those funds are designed because they know you're going to live to be 88 on average. Mm-hmm. So, of course, they have a stock portfolio big component. But if you have a die of a heart attack from the stock market this year or next because the market's been so horrible, if that happens, it doesn't matter what happens in 25 years from now.
Absolutely. Okay? Hey, Terry, I got to ask. So you talk about this, too, that, you know, 50-50, you know, some prognosticators are going to have egg on their face in a year. Some will be looking like geniuses, and we never know which way it's going to go. So when I look at, like, you know, the indicators here in the United States, you know, unemployment at record lows, the Fed keeps on increasing interest rates, which I know bugs some people, including really important people in our country. But in general, that's a sign of a healthy economy. They obviously want to give themselves an opportunity to have some easing opportunities in the future if they need it. They got to raise the rates back up. So I feel good here, but when you look internationally, you know, you see that China's having a little bit of a slowdown. So which is it? Are the markets overly spooked? Are they reflecting the actual realities of the time?
John, the market is always right. The market is always right. That's where people who meet, who agree to disagree. Every time 100 shares or 1,000 shares of stock is sold, somebody is buying it. It doesn't just disappear. Okay? Mm-hmm. Every time someone sells 100 shares of stock, even at a lower price, someone thinks, well, it's a good buy now. All right? So, number one, the market is always right. Number two, the market is not the economy. It gets tied to the economy, but we've had bear markets that didn't cause a recession. 1987, I was on the trading floor. We had the most hellacious Black Friday and then Monday and then Tuesday. And as I recall, the Dow lost like 38% in value in 3 days. It subsequently bounced back in a relatively short time, and we never had a recession. So the market and the economy are not inextricably linked. Just because you have a bear market doesn't mean you're going to have a recession. And just because you have a strong economy does not mean you couldn't have a bear market. And I would argue that's pretty much where we are now. We've got consumer spending up, the economy, we've still got people working. We don't have a bad economy. And a bear market is not going to cause a recession. But if it does, in fact, cause people to rethink decisions to invest in not just stocks, but in plants and equipment and grow the economy, then eventually, yes, you could have a recession. But they're not linked together in a way that we can say, oh, if the market plunges, we're going to have a recession. History shows that's not true.
I think that's
just because we have a strong economy doesn't mean we can't have a bear market.
Well, I think that you're bringing a really good point, because I think that market uneasiness, and if the market's always right, you know, see, it goes down, it goes up, that we fluctuate with that, even whether we have stuff invested in it a lot or not. But I think that what the fear is, Terry, is what happens in 2008 when you have these deeper recessions. You see the market going as an indicator that, oh, eventually I may lose my job. It's more than just the savings you have. You start to worry about the day-to-day expenses. And while that could eventually become the case, I guess what you're saying is to try and separate those fears a little bit. You can be worried about your 401k, but also still feel safe primarily in the day-to-day operations of your life and your budgeting going forward. It's possible to do both.
John, only if you are prepared, always prepared. No matter, forget the stock market for a moment. Everybody out there who's listening at work or driving somewhere and thinking about their job, we live in a different kind of economy. It's obvious that no longer do we have people go to work for a company at age 22 or 23 and work for 50 years or 40 years and get a gold watch and then retire. That's not the way the world works. We live in something they've called the gig economy, where you work for either for yourself as a consultant to other companies, or you may switch jobs many times, and that makes sense. So everybody's got to be playing offense and defense when it comes to your personal life. Now, the way you play defense is you're not buried in debt. I just wrote a column 2 weeks ago. Americans have more credit card debt now than they had at the peak in 2008.
Wow.
And everybody supposedly learned the lesson, I'm not going to carry a lot of debt. So here's the thing. If you have to get your own life in order, always, even in the best of times, that's the time to do it, to pay down your debt and build up your savings, have some chicken money, money market accounts, treasury bills. That's all. Just, you know, Google chicken money at terrysavage.com. You'll see a bunch of my recent articles. Always be prepared. Then you won't panic. And then, even better, if you're younger and you're a risk taker, you can take advantage of opportunities. But only if you're not panicking, only if you have some cash on the sidelines, and only if you know that you can survive this. I mean, America will survive. It always does.
Yeah, and you mentioned that
but
in the 20-year...
can you?
Yeah. Here's my question. So I have a personal finance question, Terry. I know you love to answer these. I'm not going to dive all the way deeply into my finances, but I'm getting a little bump in pay next year. I think a lot of Americans might be. I know employers are trying to keep employees around a little bit more, so hopefully everyone's getting a little bit more in wages. We're starting to see a little bump in wages, so I'm going to get a little bump, and I've been debating whether I should max out my 401k. I've got like about a six-month insurance policy in liquid cash in case something were to happen to my job. But, okay, so I'm getting a little bump, and my thought was I'm going to max out my 401k this year. The partner thinks that we've got some upcoming expenses that we're going to have that maybe I should be going down. He thinks that I shouldn't be investing any more in my 401k than the match because it's, you know, at that point you've already earned up your free money. Why go higher than that? So should I be diversifying a little bit more? Should I be putting a little bit more aside? What should I do?
So, first of all, there's relationship planning and then there's financial planning, right? And you know, Americans in general basically have a few choices. If you win just a small lottery, not the mega zillions, which is happening all around you, but if you just won a lottery, anybody out there, the first thing you have to do is look around and say, I want to pay off all my credit card debt because you're paying 19, 20, 20% interest on that. You want to pay off your student loans. Why would you be paying interest on those when if you put the money in the bank, you could or in treasury bills, you get 2.5%. Why on earth would you pay interest on anything that's 7.5 or 8? Now, your mortgage might be a little bit different. You've locked it in. Mm-hmm. Hopefully you locked it in around 4%.
Yep.
And it makes sense. And you can deduct, you know, property taxes and interest on your home mortgage up to $10,000.
Yep.
Now, that is the first decision most Americans have to make. The second decision is what's really coming around the curve? And we get blindsided by that. We think, well, I'm up to date on my credit cards. I'm making the minimum monthly payments. That's 30 years it'll take you to pay that off. So you two have to sit down. Let me put in a plug for something, a service I've written about. You can now go to terrysavage.com and put this in the search above the columns. WealthRamp, WealthRamp.com. It's a matchmaking service. They don't take your money. For certified financial planners who act as fiduciaries, who sit down with you and, first of all, agree in writing to put your interests ahead of their own, and second of all, agree to fully disclose all fees. And it could be someone in the local area or nationally. You can get to choose that. WealthRamp.com. This is when people say to me, well, he wants this or she wants that or we disagree on the other. You need to sit down with a financial planner and make a plan that both of you can be comfortable with, because what good does it do if you're rich and you have to split everything in half if you disagree?
That's true. Hey, Terry, I'm going to put you on hold for a little bit because we're going to take a quick commercial break, but we're getting some questions actually in on the text line about a little extra money laying around, so we're going to have more with Terry Savage in a moment. 720 WGN, John Hanson in for Steve Bertrand for the next few days in the Winter's Business Lunch. Oh, I'll also be hanging out here till 3. I'm in for John Williams as well today, too. Okay, Terry, I got a personal finance question from one of our listeners. You love these, don't you?
Okay. I do have fun with that.
All right, so it's from a texter who says, this texter says that they have a little extra money. They want to know if they should pay off their car. They're debt-free otherwise. They own the house, but they have a 4% loan on their car payment, and they want to know if they should just go ahead and pay that sucker off, remove the debt, or keep a little extra money around for, I don't know, you could love to call it chicken money, something like that.
Yes, I call it chicken money, and that's because you never know when an emergency will come up. So I don't know the whole picture.
Right.
That's why I mentioned finding a certified financial planner. I personally, you know, I argued with people 25 years ago before the last, you know, run up in mortgage debt. I think there's something great about living in a house where you don't have a mortgage. I eat my own cooking, so I know that works. I can't imagine having a car loan, but I definitely would not want to be without a couple months' salary and handy in the bank just in case of an emergency. I don't know what the emergency is. Maybe the emergency is, you know, your refrigerator breaks down and now there's a sale right in January and you can buy it, but it's not a sale if you're putting on a credit card and not able to pay it off for a few months because then you've paid 20% interest.
Right.
So that's up to you. I try never to buy a car. I can't imagine. I don't want to say I can't imagine. People need cars, But what's happened lately is people take car loans that last longer than the cars, 5 and 6 year loans, when in fact the car is, you've driven it and it's falling apart after 4 years. So my general thing is, if you have enough chicken money on the side, pay down your debt. You'll just feel better and you'll make smarter decisions when you're not under pressure. I think that's a big thing, everyone. I can't lift everybody the pressure. There are a lot of people. We're talking about people who have money to invest here. Let's keep in mind that there are an awful lot of people in America that are living paycheck to paycheck.
Right.
And these have been the good times. Anything you can do now to pay down your debt, there's a simple formula. Double the current minimum monthly payment on your credit card and write that number down. Make that same payment every month regardless of the new minimum. Don't charge another penny. And instead of paying interest and paying it off in 30 years, you'll have the card paid off in less than 3 years. Sometimes just the smallest thing you do makes the biggest dent. Hmm. So while those of us who invest and are fortunate enough to have IRAs and 401ks and retirement plans have important decisions to make, everybody else who's been having at least you're employed, now you can maybe get a part-time job on top of it, make whatever effort as the economy continues to be strong to make some extra money and pay down that debt. For goodness sakes, don't get caught in that same trap again. We know how that ends, painfully.
TerrySavage.com, The Savage Truth on Money, Markets, and the Economy. Terry, I always love talking with you, and I'm going to be in next week, so hopefully you can join me then too, okay?
Absolutely. That's a plan.
WGN, John Hanson in for Steve Bertrand on the Wintrust Business Lunch till 1. And I'll be in for John Williams till 3 o'clock today, all the way up to RoCon. I believe it's Brian Noonan filling in for Ro this afternoon here on this day after Christmas. We love talking to Frank Sennett from Crane Chicago Business. Frank, happy holidays to you. Thanks for joining us here on the Wintrust Business Lunch.
Thanks, John. Good to talk with you.
Are you? Did you have a great holiday? You all full? You know, you got your feet up on the couch somewhere? Are you working hard today?
Today I've got the day off, and yesterday off, so yeah, really nice week.
That's great. All right, let's jump into the story. Obviously, we've been hearing the debates between the Defense Secretary Jim Mattis and President Trump. We're not going to get into the politics of the whole thing, but what we do know is a former Chicago executive has been tapped, at least in the role as an interim defense chief. Talk to us about who this man is and how Chicagoans and certainly the business community here know him well.
Yes, we have the former head of Boeing, second-ranked official at the Pentagon now, Patrick Shanahan, stepping into the interim role. He's a former Boeing company executive, rather, who joined the administration in 2017. And, you know, he doesn't have military experience, but we typically have a civilian-led, you know, military, so that's not a huge deal. He does have a lot of experience in aerospace and, you know, delivering military contracts from his Boeing experience. So it'll be interesting to see, you know, what he does with the job, because we have some hot spots around the world that need to be tended to.
And Boeing, obviously, it goes without saying, but for those that don't know, don't only make the airplanes, of course, that we travel around in. They're a huge partner with our government and our Defense Department.
Yeah, and again, that experience will probably serve him well, and he could end up being formally nominated to replace Mattis in a permanent role. Right now, you know, we're going to see what he's able to do with, you know, the Syria situation, with the Afghanistan situation. We've got some drawdowns, some pullouts happening that have actually, you know, led to Mattis's resignation. So, you know, he's got some hot potatoes to juggle right now.
Let's talk about 875 North Michigan, which when I say that, I don't know if everyone knows what we're talking about. We're talking about the former Hancock building. It always annoys me, Frank, because when I do weather on the morning show for WCIU, we're often showing 875 North Michigan. And I like to refer to things as the name that they should be called, you know, their proper name, which is the name right now. There was some talk of maybe, you know, Sterling Bay, they had a deal in there to buy a lot of that Hancock Center, but apparently that deal has fallen through, right?
Yeah, and we had this report actually during a holiday office party at Crane's just before Christmas.
Oh gosh.
You know, yeah, so the editing was going on you know, in, you know, among the cakes and cookies. Danny Ecker nailed down this scoop. So kudos to him, just like you guys, you know, our paper's always working. Mm-hmm. So this deal was a $300 million purchase by Sterling Bay, and it seemed to be smooth sailing. It followed the $1.2 billion sterling acquisition of Prudential Plaza, and they also bought the Groupon headquarters building at 600 West Chicago Avenue. So everybody thought, you know, seems to be going smoothly. And then with no explanation as to why yet, the both parties decided to withdraw from the deal, was the announcement. And, you know, Hearn, which is the current owner, by selling it for more than $300 million, they would have made around $100 million. They bought it in 2013. For $140 million, put about $70 million into renovations. And this is the offices, which are about 89% leased, and the parking garage, the condo residential part would not include it in the deal. But yeah, they would have made $100 million, would have been probably a good deal for them. So I'll await word as to why this deal fell apart.
Yeah, it's always interesting when deals fall apart. It could be, you know, late last-minute haggling between pricing, terms of the deals. I mean, it really could be anything. I mean, these deals are probably, if you were to look at them in the actual on paper, I mean, these are, I mean, you think about me signing my mortgage for my little place up in Lakeview. That took me 45 minutes just to sign all those papers, and you could see where there's a lot of pitfalls potential, especially for a big deal like this.
Absolutely. A lot of clauses that we probably don't know about as all financing issues. Like you say, a lot of things can go wrong with a deal like this. So it'll be interesting to see how it shakes out.
Was naming going to be part of this at all? Was it going to maybe be Sterling Bay Tower or something? Or is this a completely separate thing?
Well, I hadn't heard that, but, you know, it is true that the John Hancock Insurance Company had actually requested that the building remove its name because it no longer had the ownership interest. So that name had just kind of continued, and finally they said, you know, we're not really involved anymore. Take our name off. So I guess the naming was wide open at that point.
Sounds good. All right, let's talk about this 50-year-old landmark housing discrimination case that has just been settled. That is a long time for a case to work its way through a settling process. Can you tell us the story? This is a fascinating story.
Yeah, so there's a landmark housing discrimination case that actually filed 52 years ago, back in 1966.
Wow.
And in that case, it's been dragging on forever. A federal judge has had to approve a lot of the CHA's moves. And basically, the suit was alleging that the CHA, with its public housing policies, was enhancing segregation in the city rather than working to break it down. And so now there's a settlement. After 50-some years, the CHA, if this settlement is approved, will have 5 years to, you know, put its plan into place to, you know, continue to desegregate the plan for transformation. And at that time, you know, they won't have to get judicial approval. And if all goes well, there will be a lot more low-income housing units built in neighborhoods around the city, not just, you know, segregated into a few places like in the high-rise era with Cabrini Green and the Robert Taylor homes.
So this, when I hear the word settlement, dollar signs always start flying. There's no punitive repayment to anyone or anything like that that's about their policies moving forward?
Exactly. It's about a commitment. It's a public policy issue. It's about a commitment to desegregating and building out these units. It's not going to end segregation in Chicago.
Right, right.
But experts who are looking at it say that when the plan for transformation is fully implemented in 5 years, if it is, then it will be fair to say that the CHA's units are desegregated. And then we'll still have a deficit of public housing units in the city of Chicago. There's a big waiting list. Was just reopened for the first time since 2014 recently. There are about 60,000 families currently being housed by the CHA, not nearly enough to meet the demand, unfortunately.
How did this lawsuit play out in terms of, I mean, who brings the lawsuit? Is it a collection of families? Is it the federal government? Is it organizations suing the CHA? How does that get filed in court?
Yeah, so it was a community organizer, Dorothy Gautreau, who filed the lawsuit 52 years ago, and I think, you know, it's on behalf of residents. The allegation was that they were steering low-income minorities into poor neighborhoods and packing them in and creating segregated environment. And it's gone on, like I say, for 52 years.
Wow.
And under this new agreement, the CHA will have to meet several housing obligations by 2024. And that will be including completing its plans for mixed use at Cabrini Green, the former site of those high-rises, the Lathrop homes on the north side, and the Ickes homes on the just west of McCormick Place. So they have this plan that, you know, they say they're going to meet, and if they do in 5 years, hit all those benchmarks and the judge approves, they'll be out from under this this lawsuit after more than half a century.
Frank Sennett, the Director of Digital Strategy at Crane Chicago Business. Frank, where can we find out more information about these and plenty other stories?
ChicagoBusiness.com. And a Happy New Year to everybody who listens and to you.
Happy New Year to you too, Frank. Thanks for your time, okay?
Thanks.
All right, we're going to take a quick commercial break, and then we're going to be talking about breaches, the big story of data breaches. That's coming up on 720 WGN.
Start the timer, because here's the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing and examining Chicago business news of the day. Y'all know that the healthcare industry is huge, and the market continues to grow, because the reality is, there will always be people who are sick and in need. Chicago-based Blue Cross Blue Shield is investing in fellow Chicago-based healthcare company SonarMD, at a tune of $10 million to be exact. Dr. Lawrence Kaczynski founded the startup focusing on gastrointestinal health, but he's looking to expand the health offerings and their clientele. Oh, also a little fact, the company is only running on a staff of fewer than 10 people, so they plan on doubling their staff as well in the coming year. And here's an interesting fact. As of the last year, the U.S. Census showed that Chicago is obviously one of the top biking cities in the country, but we're only along average lines when it comes to the female biking population. The census showed that the national average of female riders and commuters is about 28%, but Chicago is just at 30. The city continues to expand our bike friendliness, but we've got to ask, what else can we do to raise that number? I'm Bennett Wakenight, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
WGN. By the way, we're going to have the stories that matter from Eric Rung in the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom on WGN Radio in just a little bit. But before we get to that, we got a special guest in the studio, John Haney, CEO at Access One. John, thanks for joining us here this afternoon.
Thanks for having me.
And we just went through a whole history about how your name is Haney. It's spelled differently than Caleb Haney. And then we talked about Bears lore, and you were impressed by my Caleb Haney knowledge.
That's an amazing amount of Caleb Haney knowledge.
And now we've said his name more times than needs to be said here on Chicago radio here. Okay, we're talking about data breach stories. And, it's seemingly every single day, and it might even be more than that, the number of stories we get about data breaches in our country.
It is. It's more than every day. It's more than 10 times a day. In fact,
really?
there were 4,000 publicly announced data breaches in 2018.
When you say data breaches, are we talking about individual ones? Are we talking about at the retail store stealing a bunch of information? Are we talking about it from healthcare providers? Is it a mix of all these sorts of things?
So it's a mix of all of these things. These are announcements made publicly by businesses.
When you say publicly, does that mean that there might be some that never get reported on?
I think there are a lot that are never reported on.
I think it's obvious, I've had my credit card data taken, and it's a pain because I have to flag certain things as fraudulent, and eventually it all kind of gets settled out, and that seems easy to me. But there are some data breaches that go well beyond just your personal finances, right?
Absolutely. So what we're seeing in 2018 is large-scale data breaches taking huge quantities of records that are lasting over periods of months or even years.
Mm-hmm.
So they're taking passwords, usernames, account information. You've seen some of the DNA testing companies get hacked in the past year. So it's kind of an unlimited access to very personal information when you have that kind of intel.
Right, so we're aware of these problems. We continue to develop systems to try and prevent these sorts of things. Is the number simply going up because we continue to put more and more and more data into electronic format?
So I think that that's part of it. I think that more and more data going into an electronic format, the popularity of the cloud and kind of storing your information in the internet has huge benefits, but greater access to information also provides greater opportunity to be hacked.
I wonder if, you mentioned 4,000 public stories, plenty more other private ones. I think we become desensitized to it. For me, maybe I should worry about it more. I enter my credit card information when I buy things online. I do all sorts of things like that. I don't have like a data protection service on my data. I don't give out my social security number free willing, but should I be a little bit, do we become desensitized to this a little bit?
I think that desensitization is a huge thing. When you see something that happens, more than 10 times a day, it's easy to just kind of forget that this really is a threat to you.
Mm-hmm.
I think about the Equifax hack at the end of last year, and I think that was really the point where people kind of gave up and decided, well, all of my information is essentially public at this point. but there are a number of steps that individuals can take to protect their data.
All right, so let's walk through that, because I am of that camp. I'm of that thing. I'm like, hey, you know, if you're gonna do it, you're gonna take it, and there's no way I'm gonna be safe around this. If everyone's gonna be hacking 4,000 times a year, maybe more than that, what can we do? So there are things we can do individually.
So securing your data that's stored with third parties from other entities hacking them is very difficult, but what you can do is have, number one, secure passwords, uppercase letters, lowercase letters, numbers, special symbols, right?
That really does make a difference.
Absolutely, it makes a difference, especially for brute force attacks where they're running thousands of passwords against your account information to try to hack you.
Wait, how does that work? So they figure out what your username might be or something along those lines, and they just run password after password after password after password to try and figure out what it might be? Do they use common passwords? How do they do that?
That is definitionally a brute force attack, yes. Huh. That's exactly what it is.
So coming up with different cases and symbols, of course, right? That,
yes.
That helps it out. Changing it? How often should we be changing our passwords?
Most of your applications that you use will force you to reset them every 6 months to once a year. I think that's a fine interval as long as you have a secure password. The other thing that I stress is never trust your email, because a lot of these hacks get part of what is needed to mess with your life.
Hmm.
The other piece they get from you directly by sending you an email pretending to be someone that you do business with, whether that's your bank or your educational institution, and then they trick you into divulging additional information. So never trust an email. If you get one from someone that you do business with, re-enter the URL on your own into the web browser rather than clicking any links contained within the email. Stay away from links. They're bad news.
What about a click here? Sometimes people can hide links inside of text. Don't text those?
Exactly. Yes, okay. You're right on.
All right, so what about passwords in terms of I'm so guilty. I'm going to get hacked today, I think. I sometimes use the same password for different sites because I think, oh, well, at least I can memorize this one.
Yeah, that's dangerous, especially if you're doing business with, say, you know, you've got a Fidelity account, a Bank America account, a Chase account, all have the same passwords. You could have a really, really rough day if that gets cracked.
What, I mean, when you're talking, I'm sure you've heard horror stories from people. You know, I mentioned my story. Oh, yeah, the credit card. It took a little while to figure out. There's some actual horror stories out there of people that have had lost a lot of money and security in their own lives, right?
There really are, it's really hard to prevent. They're out there trying to get your information continuously. Thankfully, there are some new regulations and laws going into place, particularly the GDPR that you see in Europe, as American companies try to coordinate with that law in Europe. It's going to improve the level of data security at companies within the United States.
So what do you guys do at Access One?
So at Access One, we provide business infrastructure technology services to businesses.
Mm-hmm.
So that ranges everything from your kind of traditional telecom services, fiber optic internet access, to cloud-hosted phone systems, and managed IT services, including security.
And you guys know what you're doing, right?
We do. It's kind of.
Because I don't, clearly, as I've exhibited in this interview.
It's one of the most important services that we provide our customers. And, you know, kind of it's all based on, number one, education. You have to know what you're fighting against.
Mm-hmm.
Number two, prevention. Number three, detection. That's a big piece of this is, you know, a lot of companies are currently in the act of being hacked and unaware.
Mm-hmm.
And then finally, you know, what is your plan for recovery in the event of a data breach, and how do you notify your customers in a way that retains them as your customers?
Where can people find out more information about Access One?
So go to www.accessoneinc.com. And we've got all kinds of information related to business technology services, telecom, data security, hosted phone systems,
and
you
don't
find out everything you need.
And don't put your social security number anywhere.
No
on your
social
site.
Security numbers. There's nowhere to even put it.
John Haney, thanks for your time. We appreciate
Thank you.
It. And everyone stay safe with those breaches.